there's under fruitful faith, self-control, there are three verses if somebody could read those.
But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Against such things there is no law. And those who belong to Christ Jesus have crucified the flesh with its passions and desires.
Then Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. And after fasting 40 days and 40 nights, he was hungry.
I'm speaking in human terms because of your natural limitations. For just as you once presented your members as slaves to impurity and to lawlessness, leading to more lawlessness, so now present your members as slaves to righteousness, leading to sanctification.
Okay, so you could say this is the end of a long journey to learning those fruits of the Spirit, becoming those fruits of the Spirit to better understand them. But I thought something in the beginning. All of these initial fruits of the Spirit are very seemingly lovingly. Like they feel good when you think about, oh, I'd like to be kinder. I'd like to love a little bit more, be more patient. And then we get to the self-control part, and I'm like, oh, crap. Like, you mean I have to do something? I have to be a little bit better? So those are my initial thoughts in summing up the fruit. This passage where we talk about fruits of the Spirit. To preface why I'm here and why Michael asked me to do this one is kind of funny because I've learned over the years to enjoy self-control, or try to anyway. And in that vein, this is my second time to teach adults. I'm very used to teaching kids and kind of presenting my own ideas about how it is to be a teenager and what cool looks like and kind of relate that back to Jesus. But it's a little bit different when you talk to adults. And so the first time I talked to an adult group of people was I was filling in for the pastor's Sunday school class. So this is where I feel very similar in that area. And by the end, there had been a guy that got so angry that he walked out. So I don't blame myself, but I hope it doesn't happen again. So find yourself in some self-control and don't get too mad at me. So when I think of self-control, I think of where it comes from, like how we respond to somebody that says, have some self-control. So you find yourself in restraining yourself. So we restrain ourselves from things that we want to do. We restrain ourselves from doing too much of something. We restrain ourselves from maybe doing something that we want to do over what we think God wants us to do. So I'm interested to hear what you think of when you think of restraining yourself. What are some of those times that you've had to use restraint?
Well, Matt and I are all 30.
Mm.
I mean, I feel like for me, the basic definition is like need versus want.
Sure.
And I have to struggle with that every day, especially with food and things that I consume primarily, you know, like getting ready for the wedding.
Mm-hmm.
Listening to a podcast is Bert Kreischer and his friend Tom Segura, who's another comedian, and I related with it because he was saying they've got like a weight loss thing going on, and he was saying like, I literally used to think like, oh, I just nobody appreciates food like I do. like skinny people don't appreciate food like I do. But he was like, no, like they just make choices. They're making the choices not to eat too much of anything. I was like, that, like, the Lord spoke to me. I was like, oh, right. Like, I think that, like that people that are fit are just, like, depriving themselves of goodness.
It's true.
Oh, it is true.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I don't consider myself fit, but.
And I, you know, I think, you know, we often, understandably go to like food and exercise and all that. And I'm like, man, I need self-control just to get out of bed in the morning. I mean, and I don't mean that like I'm an off, like I'm struggling, you know, on the cry for help. It's just the reality of, you know, being productive, like doing the things that are required of me, like caring for my kids. Like, I want to do all those things, but, you know, I also want to just not get out of bed, or I want to be lazy. And so I think there's even that sense of restraining, kind of the self-pleasing nature to do the things I need to do to make my life life.
Mm-hmm.
I relate self-control in a different vein in my marriage, just the nature of being married to somebody who has a different personality type than you, and exercising self-control in that my gut reaction and how I want to react to Cliff, and how his gut reaction to react to me are probably, like, we relate to each other in a different way just because we are different people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Cliff is not a carbon copy of me, and I'm not a carbon copy of Cliff. And that's beautiful because we balance each other out, and that's, I think, very divine, and that, you know, we found each other, and we fell in love, and we got married, and we made vows to each other, and I think it's very beautiful, but at the same time, it can be very difficult because we're very different people, and so we have to exercise self-control and knowing and having grace for each other, and that, you know, grace has been shown to us, and so, therefore, we need to show grace to each other. We can show grace to each other. But it also requires self-control, you know, to not lash out every day of my life. Because my husband is a fantastically, like, takes up a lot of space.
Let's talk about him.
His personality and life and everything that he does. And so it's frustrating sometimes. Because he's not here. Yeah, so, exactly. You know.
Why does he always have to call me and talk for 15 minutes when he can just text me his question?
He's definitely an old soul.
He calls. Yeah. He doesn't like the text. Yeah. So what about in our faith? Like, maybe not just what we think about our own lives, but what about exercising restraint as it relates to our faith? And to kind of go along with that, me teaching a lot of teenagers, there's a lot of definites that we have to define, like we have to show them, like, in your faith, if you do this, you are a sinner. You kind of have to spell it out a little bit. But when you get older, it gets a little bit more gray. Like, for me, it's very easy for me to talk to teenagers about not drinking alcohol because they're not old enough. I can, like they can't argue that. But now that we're older, how do those things that we were like trying so hard not to do as younger people, don't cuss, don't drink, don't do this, don't do that, because God wouldn't like us to be that way. We learn as we're older that that's not totally the truth. So we have restraint means a little bit more, maybe something a little bit different. So how do those things relate to your relationship with God? I'm curious.
I think for me, the physical is kind of definition of how it relates to the spiritual. If I practice obedience by not eating like cookies for every meal of the day, then I'm going to feel good, I'm going to be healthy, I'm going to live a better life. In a similar vein, if I practice obedience by worshiping more and entering into prayer, I'm going to receive these spiritual blessings and gifts. So I think it's very like purposeful to have this very physical understanding.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like mine is tied back to like, what am I actually calling freedom? Like, what does freedom actually look like?
Mm-hmm.
So, and that ties to trust. Like, do I trust that God has His people's best interest in mind?
Right.
God taught me a few years ago of like to trust Him. That He created the world, He knows the best, the most flourishing way to live in the world. And so obedience is not a is not a, obedience is not a binding, not a bound slavery from enjoyment, but it's a freedom of what the image of God is actually. Buddy Paul Tripp has an I think it's in that book analogy of you know, he doesn't cheat on his wife, and so he never goes to a restaurant with his wife and sees like possibly a girl he's cheating on with her car, and think, oh, I can't go to that restaurant. He says I can go to, with my wife, I can go anywhere in town because I have that freedom. He relates that to what freedom in Christ is God is actually like pursuing us and wants good for us. And so what freedom is and what trust, like how do we actually trust God?
I'm particularly like thinking about the idea of freedom all the time, and the idea of what it means to be free from sin, and going with that, like he's free to go wherever he wants. I didn't wake up today and say, man, I'm going to try really hard to restrain from killing somebody. I don't have those thoughts. To me, that's a true freedom. Like, you're not even restraining yourself from doing something. You just, what you do. You're free to go to any restaurant because you're not going to run into anybody like that. The fruits of the Spirit are showing us and modeling for us how to feel freedom, and modeled by Jesus in what he was showing us. He was showing us how to be loving, showing us how to be kind, to be patient. And we get to self-control, and I'm like, did Jesus have to show self-control? Like, if he was this without sin, did he have to restrain himself from doing something that he wasn't supposed to do? Did he do something but kind of went too far? Maybe he had to restrain himself from doing too much of something. This is one of those questions that I actually had to ask Michael about. Like my initial response is like, no, he's perfect. But why is it in there? Why is it on the list? Does anybody have some ideas? Is there a spot that Jesus showed self-control, that modeled it for us?
Oh, maybe that prayer when he's asking God to take this from him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he definitely, at that moment, reveals to us that he cannot do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I feel maybe like God practiced self-control by, you know, giving us Jesus, by giving us Christ.
Sure.
In a big way, you know.
Yeah.
I saw this one pastor that I really admire say, he's like laughing as he's saying this. He goes, I love that, you know, God exhibits a bit of self-control, because if he didn't, we'd all be dead.
Yeah.
Okay. Got me. Like, he restrained himself from acting out on us. Good point.
What about when Jesus was tempted before the crucifixion? Back in Matthew, then Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. And after fasting 40 days and 40 nights, he was hungry. So I left out the three times that he was tempted by the tempter, is what my translation said. Just for sake of being a teacher, do we remember what those three things were? What are the three ways that Jesus was tempted?
Bread.
That was the first one. He was hungry.
Water.
Was it?
Did
the teacher.
I didn't write it down.
You can stop all this, right? Just be like God and you have the power.
Yep.
Was that the second one? Third?
I think it was the second one. I don't remember.
To throw himself off the temple and have the angels save him, to make a big display of his power.
Mm-hmm. So I was interested if we knew those, and I intentionally didn't write them down because the more I read it, the more I thought, that's not what I want to talk about. I want to talk about why Jesus was led up by the Spirit. Why did he fast for 40 days and 40 nights? Why did he make it even harder on himself?
Non-rhetorical question.
Non-rhetorical question.
Well, it's interesting because I was thinking about, because whenever the disciples were asked about fasting, he says, you know, the bridegroom is here. Yeah. And then he you're saying, like, he fasts for 40 days. And the most, you know, before he begins his ministry. Like, so, like, before he, like, embarks on this big, you know, narrative anyway, but, like, he fasts for 40 days.
Now that you talk about trust, I feel like the fact that he was led by the Spirit, he had to exercise trust that he was, cliche, not going to be able to, not going to do something that he wasn't strong enough to handle. But also, why was he fast? Like, what do you feel when you fast and then somebody says, don't you want some bread? That's probably on the forefront of your mind, right? Like, absolutely. This all could be over if I just get what I want. But why would he model that?
Well, part of it is he's modeling the archetype of Moses, who also fasted for 40 days. Mm-hmm. And that's when Moses was getting the law on the mountain with God. And he comes out, so there's this piece of the beginning of his ministry, and it's a different shape of ministry than Moses did. Instead of giving law, he gives grace. Mm-hmm. So in a way, it's archetypical, but that's not the point. That's just drawing our imagination into the bigger story to make a new point. And I think part of that is what we're seeing here, is that, under the most dire circumstances, Jesus was able, by the Spirit, to resist, to exercise self-control. Mm-hmm. And what it shows is that he didn't use necessarily his divinity to do this. He was very much a man. He was very much like us in the same way. He was tempted like us. And so he was showing us how we, like him, can overcome temptation.
Mm-hmm. That was okay. That was an okay all answer. Right. Yeah. Does anybody have anything else to add to that?
You can just feel how much he craves intimacy with his Father. And fasting, I think, is a great model of that. And when I think of all the times when I exercise self-control or even, like, restraining my language or restraining anything, it really points back to the Father and kind of giving me these other choice things to do, like patience, you let me be kind to you. But it's that restraint that really draws me to God.
For me, I'm mildly obsessed with the existence of choice. Like, the mind, you can choose. What if there was no choice? And I actually didn't write this down, but I'm just hearing this right now from you guys, is that even we should choose because we have already been chosen. Jesus chooses to be baptized. I'm always baffled at that because did Jesus need to get baptized? I don't really think so. Like, did he need to be tempted? Absolutely not. But he chose to. He chose to model these things. He chose these things for us. So I just enjoy wrestling with that idea. And the thing about Scripture to me and the things that I read, being a green personality, showing restraint because I know something else will get better, that formula doesn't necessarily work all the time. I'm absolutely baffled at the fullness of communication in the Bible, like the fullness of every single letter. There's not a means to an end. There's not a formula. There's a fullness. There's a beginning and an end at the same time. We talked about grace a little bit. What shall we say then? Are we to continue to sin that grace may abound? By no means. Now that we have grace, should we just do whatever we want because we have it? Absolutely not. But at the same time, absolute freedom from restraint is in itself restraining to me. So I have a video, and I'm going to read Romans 6:19 while he pulls that up. To kind of set this up, I was teaching film, and I realized that the inherent school model, like, here's something that I have that you need to learn, and that's important. I just could never find this importance. Like, what is it? What does it matter that you can make a video? It doesn't. So what do I get out of this? What do I teach these kids? We need to learn to communicate. We need to learn to be creative. We need to learn to figure out this formula to have freedom to create. Because I don't want you to just do what I ask you to do, because you're not going to learn anything. So to set this up, Romans 6:19, I'm speaking in human terms. Because of your natural limitations, for just as you once presented your members as slaves to impurity and to lawlessness leading to more lawlessness, so now present your members as slaves to righteousness leading to sanctification. So what if self-control was not only something that you needed to practice, but a call to action at the same time? The fullness of the term self-control. Don't only practice restraint, but in turn do something about it. So this is a video that I showed to every student I ever came across about how to be creative, but also to combat what they've heard their entire lives, like you have and me. Think outside the box. Be totally free to do what you want. And I was going to say this after, but I think it's just like the perfect example. A lot of you guys have cats, and they are very intrigued by the outside world. As soon as they get out into the front yard and they like venture out, they're frozen. Like, well, now what do I do? Like, I have absolute freedom to go anywhere I want, but now I can't go anywhere because I can't make that choice because too many. So what do we do about that? So this is something that I show. This is also my way of showing the gospel in schools that I'm not allowed to do, but hopefully it sparks conversation with kids. Yeah, I just love this video. So let's watch it.
So when I was in art school, I developed a shake in my hand, and this was the straightest line I could draw. Now, in hindsight, it was actually good for some things, like mixing a can of paint or shaking a Polaroid. But at the time, this was really doomed. This was the destruction of my dream of becoming an artist. The shake developed out of really a single-minded pursuit of pointillism, just years of making tiny, tiny dots. And eventually, these dots went from being perfectly round to looking more like tadpoles because of the shake. So to compensate, I hold a pen tighter, and this progressively made the shape worse, so I hold a pen tighter still. And this became a vicious cycle that ended up causing so much pain and joint issues, I had trouble holding anything. And after spending all my life wanting to do art, I left art school, and then I left art completely. But after a few years, I just couldn't stay away from art, and I decided to go to a neurologist about the shake and discovered I had permanent nerve damage. And he actually took one look at my squiggly line and said, well, why don't you just embrace the shake? So I did. I went home, I grabbed a pencil, and I just started letting my hands shake and shake. I was making all these scribble pictures. And even though it wasn't the kind of art that I was ultimately passionate about, it felt great. And more importantly, once I embraced the shake, I realized I could still make art. I just had to find a different approach to making the art that I wanted. Now, I still enjoyed the fragmentation of pointillism, seeing these little tiny dots come together to make this unified whole. So I began experimenting with other ways to fragment images where the shape wouldn't affect the work, like dipping my feet in paint and walking on a canvas. Or in a 3D structure consisting of 2x4s, creating a 2D image by burning them with a blowtorch. I discovered that if I worked on a larger scale and with bigger materials, my hand really wouldn't hurt. And after having gone from a single approach to art, I ended up having an approach to creativity that completely changed my artistic horizons. This was the first time I'd encountered this idea that embracing the limitation could actually drive creativity. At the time, I was finishing up school, and I was so excited to get a real job and finally afford new art supplies. I had this horrible little set of tools, and you know, I felt like I could do so much more with the supplies I thought an artist was supposed to have. I actually didn't even have a regular pair of scissors. I was using these metal shears until I stole a pair from the office that I worked at. So I got out of school, I got a job, I got a paycheck, I got myself to the art store, and I just went nuts buying supplies. And then when I got home, I sat down and I set myself to test it, really try to create something just completely outside of the box. But I sat there for hours, and nothing came to mind. The same thing the next day, and then the next, quickly slipping into a creative slump. And I was in a dark place for a long time, unable to create. And it didn't make any sense, because I was finally able to support my art, and yet I was creatively blank. But as I searched around in the darkness, I realized I was actually paralyzed by all the choices that I never had before. And it was then that I thought back to my jittery hands, embraced the shake. And I realized if I ever wanted my creativity back, I had to quit trying so hard to think outside of the box and get back into it. I wondered, could you become more creative then by looking for limitations? What if I could only create with a dollar's worth of supplies? At this point, I was spending a lot of my evenings in, well, I guess I still spend a lot of my evenings in Starbucks, but I know you can ask for an extra cup if you want one. So I decided to ask for 50. Surprisingly, they just handed them right over, and then with some pencils I already had, I made this project for only 80 cents. It really became a moment of clarification for me that we need to first be limited in order to become limitless. I took this approach of thinking inside the box to my canvas and wondered, what if instead of painting on a canvas, I could only paint on my chest? So I painted 30 images, one layer at a time, one on top of another, with each picture representing an influence in my life. Or what if instead of painting with a brush, I could only paint with karate chops? So I dipped my hands in paint and I just attacked the canvas, and I actually hit so hard that I bruised a joint in my pinky and it was stuck straight for a couple weeks. Or, what if instead of relying on myself, I had to rely on other people to create the content for the art? So, for 6 days, I lived in front of a webcam, I slept on the floor, and I ate takeout. And I asked people to call me and share a story with me about a life-changing moment. Their stories became the art as I wrote them onto the revolving canvas. Or, what if instead of making art to display, I had to destroy it? This seemed like the ultimate limitation, being an artist without art. This destruction idea turned into a year-long project that I called Goodbye Art, where each and every piece of art had to be destroyed after its creation. In the beginning of Goodbye Art, I focused on forced destruction, like this image of Jimi Hendrix, made with over 7,000 matches. Then I opened it up to creating art that was destroyed naturally. I looked for temporary materials, like spitting out food. Sidewalk chalk. And even frozen wine. The last iteration of destruction was to try to produce something that didn't actually exist in the first place. So I organized candles on a table, I lit them and then blew them out. Then repeated this process over and over with the same set of candles. Then assembled the videos into the larger image. So the end image was never visible as a physical whole. It was destroyed before it ever existed. In the course of this Goodbye Art series, I created 23 different pieces with nothing left to physically display. What I thought would be the ultimate limitation actually turned out to be the ultimate liberation, as each time I created, the destruction brought me back to a neutral place where I felt refreshed and ready to start the next project. It did not happen overnight. There were times when my projects failed to get off the ground, or even worse, after spending tons of time on them, the end image was kind of embarrassing. But having committed to the process, I continued on. Something really surprising came out of this. As I destroyed each project, I was learning to let go. Let go of outcomes, let go of failures, and let go of imperfections. And in return, I found a process of creating art that's perpetual and unencumbered by results. I found myself in a state of constant creation, thinking only of what's next and coming up with more ideas than ever. When I think back to my 3 years away from art, away from my dream, just going through the motions, instead of trying to find a different way to continue that dream, I just quit. I gave up. And what if I didn't embrace the shake? Because embracing the shake for me wasn't just about art and having art skills. It turned out to be about life and having life skills. Because ultimately, most of what we do takes place here, inside the box, with limited resources. Learning to be creative within the confines of our limitations is the best hope we have to transform ourselves and collectively transform our world. Looking at limitations as a source of creativity changed the course of my life. Now when I run into a barrier or I find myself creatively stumped, I sometimes still struggle, but I continue to show up for the process and try to remind myself of the possibilities. Like using hundreds of real live worms to make an image. Using a pushpin to tattoo a banana. Or painting a picture with hamburger grease. One of my most recent endeavors is to try to translate the habits of creativity that I've learned into something others can replicate. Limitations may be the most unlikely of places to harness creativity, but perhaps one of the best ways to get ourselves out of ruts, rethink categories, and challenge accepted norms. And instead of telling each other to seize the day, maybe we can remind ourselves every day to seize the limitation. Thank you.
So I'm going to read Romans 6:19 again. I am speaking in human terms because of your natural limitations. For just as you have once presented your members as slaves to impurity and to lawlessness, leading to more lawlessness, so now present your members as slaves to righteousness, leading to sanctification. I'd like to hear your take on what that video is about based on freedom and limitation. Does that resonate with you?
I guess for me, I think of like what it actually means to be made in the image of God.
Mm-hmm.
And I was actually even thinking about that on the way here because Oliver was being funny and he was saying just like funny stuff, but he said, "I am God." And I started like thinking about that, like, you know, the image of God. But like the image of God for me means that God has created me in His likeness, but acknowledging that God is like ultimately creative, and that's why there's so many differences in us and so many unity pieces. But the fact that I am becoming more of an image of God as I'm understanding myself. and understanding, like, and you could go, like, you could say, like, I'm never going to be a NBA basketball player, but I'm going to be the best, like, whatever God has created me to be.
Mm-hmm.
So you can look at it as limitations of that I'm not 7 foot tall and can shoot a basketball, but that I can do other things that God actually created me to do.
Mm-hmm.
So this is especially pertinent for me. I have a form of OCD that I'm a dietary trainer. That it doesn't look like Monk, where I'm necessarily like counting steps or like double cleaning everything. But it's about the compulsive, the way that you make decisions and make choices. And so it's where I have to like make the absolute best decision every time. And so I have to like really go through this crazy analytical process to make a choice. And it's very debilitating, and particularly when you have a lot of choices. And I'm like, what's the right one? And I feel like, and so grace has been really good in schooling me to trust that it's okay if I make the wrong choice, or, you know, I don't have to kill myself over this. But what I've learned, though, is that in our culture particularly, we just have a myriad of choices. I mean, it's, have it your way. Some variation of that is like the tagline of nearly every, you know, restaurant and all these different places. And this idea is, it can be kind of overwhelming. How do I choose? How do I know what's the right way? And so when you go to a place that, and I guess sticking with the food industry, I like going to a place that they, like, this is how it is, and I'm like, just give it to me like that. And like discovering food that I maybe never would have eaten before. And, you know, that's kind of an innocuous example, but I think it plays out in other ways where by limiting our space for work or whatever, it opens us up to new realities and new possibilities that weren't there prior.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it's comforting. You know, I don't have this weight of responsibility about, you know, choices. It's really helpful for me.
Mm-hmm. So even while I was trying to measure up to how to talk about this, I was thinking, what would Michael have said? Or how do I be revolutionary in my thought? Like, how do I give you something that you really appreciate? And I was absolutely stifled by the amount of angles that I could take. The absolute vastness of knowledge that you can get from the Bible. So, like, how can I even pick a verse? Eventually, you get to a point where you're just like, here's the Bible, read it. I don't know what to say. Because it just, like, builds in this, that fullness of, like, there's not a means to an end. This, it's full. It's there. It is there, and it always has been. There's this vastness of knowledge that you can get. So what is that limitation to ultimate freedom? To appreciate self-control, to appreciate not only being patient, peaceful, joyous, being good and kind and faithful, but perpetually doing those things. Not having to be bound by, I have to be kind right now, because, even though I don't want to. But finding limitation as freeing to be perpetually kind. Like he was saying, viewing those limitations into being perpetually creative. And finding those limitations as reminders that you are an image of God in the first place. I had to remind myself who I am in order to free my mind up to say anything. So it started out as, how do I be this theologian that picks apart self-control and proves to you that I'm smarter than you are? I just didn't feel good about that. Because I'm not. I'm not educated as far as like finishing seminary. But I have my own experiences. I would love to be that guy that can just talk about logic and apologetics all day and just prove faith to you all the time. But I'm not. I just can't. But what I do have is my experience. And my experience in a relationship with Jesus, that is absolutely freeing to be gracious and to be thoughtful and to use my experience to prove faith to people around me. But it's only because of self-control, because of limitations, because of appreciating that I need to be more kind and joyous and peaceful. And Jesus did model those things. It is possible to be absolutely free. As soon as I kind of grasp that Michael was saying, just do you, man. Do it how you would do it. I'm like, that's easy for you to say. Like, you do this all the time. But so I started to think, who am I? Like, I'm a natural teacher. I'm a natural thinker. I've taught kids how to be creative before. And where did I get? I like, just started flowing with words to say. How do I equate self-control to being an action? Just like I've done before. If I want to be free to create, I have to first limit myself. I have to show restraint so that I can be free to think. Just like that cat. As long as you're inside the house, you're free to do whatever you want. But as soon as you get out in the front yard, you can't move because you're afraid to make the wrong choice. Even as an athlete, I struggle with feeling like I couldn't be creative because that's not what athletes do. But I realize that we all have the capacity to be creative and to be free thinking and literally creators. Because if we are the image of God, and he is the original OG creator, I can do that too. So there's a poem or a spoken word that I just love to repeat over in my head. And so there's a particular piece to that just like I think about all the time. And so it's by Propaganda. He's a rapper and spoken word artist, and he has a spoken word called Too Creative. So to set it up a little bit, he was being challenged that he wasn't creative enough. He wasn't Christ-centered enough. Like, where's that point where you're saying, I'm good? And then he says, like Christ wasn't afraid to mix spit with mud, as if he couldn't fix vision with one word. I'm sorry, I get my creativity from my Father. Like, it's who you are. You are the image of God. God modeled limitation for us so that we could be free. So we could be, what does it say? Slaves to righteousness leading to sanctification. The idea that you're not slave to the law, but slaves to righteousness so that you can be sanctified. That's not a period. That's an exclamation point to me. Just because I was an athlete, I'm not an artist, or I can't paint, or I can't save everybody, or I can't be the one that comes up to you and gives you a word that you're going to love. Like, that just proves to me that I'm limited. I tend to be the elder brother in the story, where I do everything right, and if you follow me, you'll do it too. Like, you're not, and I find myself stifled by my own limitations because they're mine. Like, they're human. They're like, I'm reminded that I'm not 7 feet tall, instead of just being reminded that I'm an image of God that can be something. So I do appreciate self-control. I do think Jesus modeled it so that we could be free to perpetuate love, perpetuate grace for other people, perpetuate all of those fruits of the Spirit. So that self-control part is the exclamation point on the end of the sentence to me. And so that's what I think about that.
Well said. So as we approached his table, we were reminded that God has limited himself, as James has told us very well.